Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Nate Marshall. Nate Marshall is from the south side of Chicago. He's a Caveh Kanem Fellow whose work has appeared in Poetry Magazine, The New Republic, Indiana Review, and elsewhere. He is co-editor of the Breakbeat Poets, New American Poetry in the Age of Hip-Hop. His new book from the University of Pittsburgh Press is called Wild Hundreds and is the winner of the 2014 Agnes Lynch Sterrett Poetry Prize. He has won the Hurston Wright Founding Members Award and the Gwendolyn Brooks Open Mic Award. He is an assistant professor at Northwestern and is a member of the poetry collective Dark Noise and is also a rapper. Hi, Nate. How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Good, good.
Thanks for being here from Chicago. We're really happy that you're here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Okay. So you're going to start with some poems from Wild Hundreds.
Sure, sure, sure.
Okay.
All right. So, yeah, the first poem I'll read is, it's called Picking Flowers. Yeah, I'll just read it. Grandma's rose bush, reminiscent of a vice lord's do-rag. The unfamiliar bloom in Mrs. Bradley's yard banging a gangster disciple style blue. The dandelions all over the park putting on Latin King gold like the Chicano cats over east before they turn into a puff of smoke like all us colored boys. Picking dandelions will ruin your hands, turn their smell into a bitter cologne. A man carries flowers for three reasons. He is in love. He is in mourning. He is a flower salesman. I'm on the express train passing stops to a woman. Maybe she's home. I have a bouquet in my hand laid on one of my arms like a shotgun. The color is brilliant. A gang war wrapped and cut diagonal at the stems. I am not a flower salesman. That is the only thing I know. Cool. Then I'll read, what's the next thing I'll read? Yeah, I'll read, this is called Harold's Chicken Shack number 86. So Harold's Chicken Shack is, it's a restaurant in Chicago. It's like a chain restaurant, fried chicken spot, and it's sort of famous in the city. And it kind of has like an interesting history in that it started on the South Side by a guy named Harold Pierce, and it kind of started because as a response to a kind of racism, right? So when like fast food places and other kind of restaurateurs wouldn't go into black neighborhoods, this dude Harold Pierce sort of saw a gap in the market and began to prepare chicken in a particular way, and it kind of, you know, became famous. So, I have a number of Harold's Chicken Shack poems in the book and some that aren't in the book. And this is one of them. This is Harold's Chicken Shack number 86. Another thing I should say is, so the number, I have not actually written 86 Harold's poems. The number comes from, each restaurant has a number. So the numbering system seems to be kind of random, at least to like me as a casual observer of Harold's Chicken Shacks. So the poems have numbers that don't necessarily correspond to like the order in which they were written, but they're often like a sort of like a small joke to myself. So Harold's Chicken Shack number 86, the epigraph is this. We're trying to eliminate the shack. Kristen Pierce, Harold's CEO. When I went to summer camp, the white kids had a tendency to shorten names of important institutions. Make Northwestern University into NU, International Relations into IR. Everybody started calling me Nate. Before this, I imagined myself Nathaniel A., maybe even N. Armstead to big up my granddad. I wrote my whole name on everything. Eventually, I started unintentionally introducing myself as Nate. It never occurred to me that they could escape the knowing of my name's real length. As a shorty, most of the kids in my neighborhood couldn't say my name. McDaniel, Nathaniel, McDonald shot across the courts like wild heaves toward the basket. The subconscious visual of a chicken shack seems a poor fit for national expansion. Harold's chicken is easier. Sounds like Columbus's flag stuck into a cup of coleslaw. Shack sounds too much like home of poor people, like haven for weary, like building our own. Cool. And then, I'll read this one. So this next poem is called Palindrome, and it's after Liesl Mueller. On her profile, I see she has two kids. Now one she had in high school, now none at all. She unaborts one. She is unpregnant in eighth grade. She unresembles her favorite pop singer, Pink. She uncuts her hair. It pulls into her scalp from clumps on the floor. Her new boyfriend forgets the weight of her. She leaves her new boyfriend. He's forgetting her phone number. She becomes my girlfriend. She picks up the phone and I am on the line, ungiving a goodbye. Her best friend trades letters between us. We each open letters from ourselves with hearts on the outside. She transfers to our magnet school. She moves to a neighborhood close by. We separate at the lips. We have never kissed behind the school. She unchecks the yes box on the note and I take away my middle school love letter. I unmeet her cop father and her Chicano moms. We walk backward into Baskin Robbins, throwing up gold medal ribbon ice cream into cups. It rounds into scoops, flattens into gallon drums of sugar and cream and coldness. We are 6 years old. Maybe we can go back to then. I unlearn her name, the way it is spelled the same, backward. How it flips on a page or in my mouth. I never knew words could do that until 5 minutes from now. Cool. And then I will do one more. So this is a little thing that I wrote. Actually, my senior year of college, I am good at procrastinating, very good at procrastinating. And so I was supposed to be writing a paper, and instead I wrote this. Let me interject for a minute. Seems the ways to raise the crowd is infinite. A million ways to make the beat complete. So I'ma try and compete to speak unique. So first to start, let me kick it Petrarch. So people know I'm ambitious with the craft. This is for professors who suspicious of the raps. They should understand there's a rigor to the art. Please watch how I noun verbs make a new word. I dean's list the spits, I kick it too nerd. You heard the flow is bluebird, pretty and fly. Even MFA committees can't lie. When they give me that degree, I'll happily stop letting y'all download the raps for free. I'ma publish them as poems on the Amazon. Put it on your Kindle. The dough will get back to me. Cool.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Nate Marshall, reading from his book, Wild Hundreds. So I wanted to ask you about what you were just referring to, Nate.
Sure.
Language and the way that you move from different kinds of language in your book, different kinds of diction, vernacular speech, everyday speech, to more formal speech in a poem.
Sure.
And can you talk about that decision to do that and what goes into that decision?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so in many ways, like, it is a decision, certainly. Like, I think, we're poets, right? So we have to be invested that in the intentionality of language at some point. But I guess for me, it's a very natural decision to make in that I think this is how I speak, right? Like, when I speak, I draw from all of those different parts of myself, right? The parts of myself that are profane, that like deeply love and are like really are invested and excited by vernacular, the parts of myself that are like all about like reading and discovering new words and figuring that out, right? Like, yeah. So much of me is just, I think that I'm wrapped up in at the intersections between all those different languages and kinds of language. So my work reflects that.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you have some made up words. You have some inside joke words.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little about like, for our listeners out there, I mean, why would a poet want to have an inside joke that no one would get in his book?
Sure. Right. So, I think for me, the best poems work on multiple levels, right? And some of those levels are like submerged or they're personal to me, right? So sometimes I write a thing or present it in a particular way that I know I'm only going to get. And that's okay. That's sort of like half the fun of it, right? Like if we were online, right? If we were like on Twitter, then what would you call it? Like a subtweet, right? Where you like refer to something, but not by name and vague enough that the people who might know the situation won't be able to identify it as exactly that situation. And I think that there's something kind of fun to that for me. Like, yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more poems?
Sure. So I'll read. So this next poem is called Recycling. It's your first year of college and you should be missing home by now, but mostly you don't. You read the Chicago newspapers and call family on Sundays. You pick up going to church at a place adjacent to the projects. You're not from the projects and the ones in Chicago seem worse, but there's comfort in being around plain spoken folk. The church folk feed you and also cook you food. You take African American studies classes and sleep through Spanish and write poems at night. You read the newspaper. You consider pledging a fraternity. You go to parties to watch people. You don't miss home. You call your ex-girl a lot. You imagine her face across the phone line. You stare at the scar on her chin. It is shiny and smooth. You read the newspaper. You text new girls mostly. You invite them to play cards and bet clothes or take them to dinner on your birthday so you don't spend it alone, or you share their extra long twin beds, or you just text them. It's your first year of college, and your nephew is tiny, and your niece is young enough to be happy, and the world is new. And you are not going home for Thanksgiving. You are in the South at a new friend's house. You go to church with his family and to his old high school's basketball games and to his malls and to his grandmother's house. You did not make your team past ninth grade and never went to malls much. Your grandmother has been dead for 2 years now. You read the newspaper. His family are nice people. You do not miss home. You go back to school. You stop talking to your ex-girl. She has a new guy. You do not miss home. You write poems. You read the newspaper. There are still more kids dying. Your first year of college and you should be missing, but you're still here. You write papers about black people and voting and violence and families, and that is the same paper. You don't read the newspaper. You have finals to finish. You go to church on Sunday with your new friend and you talk to new girls and consider pledging. You have heard the fraternities will haze you. You have heard about beating, but you are not from the projects and you are not in Chicago. You stop reading the newspaper. You decide to kiss a girl and mean it. You decide to pledge a fraternity. You should have more information about the newspaper and the girl and the fraternity. You should call home more. You don't read newspapers or call. You are not from the projects or Chicago. You do not miss home or your ex-girl or your newspaper. There are still more kids dying. You convince your new friend to pledge the fraternity. He worries about the hazing, the beatings. You tell him, this is opportunity. Don't miss it. Cool. And then I'll read Fame, Food, and Liquor. We cut down 115th Street for a quicker stroll. Past the pastor's house, vacant lot, liquor store. Buses pointing out the hood and back. The route every morning goes by the liquor store. The loose Philly blunts, hard and dry. the sour mouth washed away by a dull gulp of liquor. Store a honey bun in your fat back pocket. Pray nobody notices your awkward walk. This liquor store sees stumbling often. Out front, the garish stickers fluoresce on the wire windows like winos with liquor store bottles. A small weapon sits behind the counter, hidden by the cigarettes and candy small enough to steal. When the liquor store is locked up, the rolling metals make the window a pastoral, part of our natural habitat. Behold, the liquor store, the sugar waters, the Ziploc bag of coins, and Nate's tongue the color of loose pennies in the liquor store.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Nate Marshall. He's reading from his book, Wild Hundreds. You know, it's almost like no matter what poem you're reading, I keep thinking about home and Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, I mean, those words come up, but not every time, but it's still there. And, you know, I'm thinking about, you know, your book begins with a quote by James Baldwin.
Yeah.
Which is, you don't ever leave home. You take your home with you. You better. Otherwise, you're homeless. Would you talk about the relationship between home and writing your poetry?
Sure. I think it's always been. So I come from a particular place in Chicago, right? So I'm from the far south side of the city, right? So it's an interesting place in that I think it's often a part of the city that gets overlooked in some ways. And then when it gets talked about, it's talked about in like very reductive, like sort of stereotypical manners, right? So it's one of the neighborhoods that folks talk about when they talk about like violence in Chicago, whatever, that kind of thing, right? So I think the thing about being from a place like that is that is marginalized in those like psychic ways, but also literally at the margins. Like we're literally sort of on the border between, like, you know, we're, you know, I'm some of the last communities that you hit before you leave the city. It kind of makes you, or at least it made me really conscious and really that I wanted to be a writer that that celebrated those spaces and that celebrated the sort of like the overlooked and the underlooked and the underreported. So for me, I think like that's the first thing, right? Because even being like a writer in Chicago, you know, you say, oh, yeah, I'm from West Pullman. Folks are like, oh, where is that? You know, if they're not from the city, or even if they are from the city, it's not a place that they've been unless they have folks out there usually. Mm-hmm. And then once I left Chicago and like went to Tennessee for school, I went to Vanderbilt. Then it became even more stark because I was sort of like using writing as like one of the ways to negotiate like what was homesickness or culture shock or whatever, right?
Yeah. I guess I'm just thinking also of framing in that, you know, using the James Baldwin quote,
yeah.
And you know, using or having a number of Harold Chicken Shack poems,
yeah.
And you know, it seems like you've leaned into the framing in the book. You know, before we get to James Baldwin. Before we get to the table of contents, you know, you have some dedications.
Yeah.
This book is for my grandparents. I don't know if I'll get the names right.
Yeah. Eola
and James, yeah. Senior, Mickey and May Francis.
Yeah.
For bringing us to the hundreds and teaching us how to make home in a new place.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to the victims of state-supported and sanctioned Black Death, from Emmett Till to Damo Franklin to Rakia Boyd, our lives matter. Y'all still live because we still live and write and fight. I mean, speaking of intentionality as a writer, mm-hmm. There's some serious framing in the book. And I wondered, when you were putting this together, if you always knew you would have that kind of framework, or if that was after you got the book published, you said, okay, I'm going to add this, I'm going to do this, or, you know what I mean, what compelled you? Because it feels like Chicago and home is all through it. And yet it feels like there's a almost like an imprint that says, don't miss this or something.
Yeah. So certainly in terms of that, like, dedication, that was one of the last things that I wrote for the book. But I think that idea was always fairly close to the surface, right? Yeah. So I think that there's poems for me that think through, you know, some of those moments, right? Those moments of police murders or even just like my grandparents, right? And their and sort of how their journey enables or frames my journey, right? But ultimately, like, you know, like that I think it was important to dedicate this first book especially to those folks because, you know, both sets of them for very different reasons are like my ancestors, right? So they, like, their existence in some way enables me, my existence, and enables, like, my ability to tell whatever stories that I share across the text. Yeah.
Okay. Could you read some more?
Sure. Can I read something new?
Sure.
All right. Cool. So, yeah, I'll read this one. So, all right, so this is called Better Worse. Let me put it to you like this, fam. Terrorists are freedom fighters. Our police are gang members, our cousins, our politicians, our teachers, our protectors, our love, our loathing, depending on your vantage point. Like the time them guys jumped me and tried to run my pockets. They were frantic and afraid, and I could tell because of the shallow, quick kicks they offered to my skinny body. I think they meant to rob me, but they ran their hands into the wrong pocket because I'm left-handed. So in a sense, writing didn't save my life, but it kept my bus card from being replaced and my few dollars from disappearing. Oh, praise writing for being the savior of my state ID. These dudes were about the same size as me, but they were four and I a single me. And when they got off the bus at the stop, I noticed they wore all the name brands we loved but can't remember now. My gear was anonymous and dark like our faces. I was just a hoodie and a surprising punch back. These days, I think about how they slipped my knee from behind and had all the leverage to stomp whatever part of me. And I get my religion. Praise that day I became a polytheist. Praise my four gods, and I pray for my four gods often as I pray for myself. And praise the gods they find or will find or who have found them in churches and parties and coffins and corner stores. Were they bad murderers or good neighbors? I'm saying this. Cats could really end a mug if they had better aim. Or worse aim, depending on your vantage point. It's like bad meaning bad or bad meaning good, depending. I mean, really, it's like not believing in police because you don't believe in police when they sit in your mama's house and tell her nothing can be done because they don't do things, really. Let me put it to you like this, fam. Terrorists are freedom fighters, our police, our gang members, our cousins, our politicians, our teachers, our protectors, our love, our loathing, depending. Cool. And then I'll read another new one. So this is called My Grandfather Shot Himself in the Head. And everybody be all, wait, Nate, let's unpack this. Or what was it like? And I say it was the 70s, so I assume polyester was involved. But I was like 15 years from birth, so that's mostly hypothetical. And I've never talked to my dad about it, but I heard from somewhere that he was the one that found my grandfather dead, but maybe that was an exaggeration. Also, there's the story of my dad's hair starting to fall out after that, but that must be a lie because I've seen the pictures with S-curl, and that has to be the early 90s. And it seems like a waste to regrow your hair and use the second life for a curl, that's a deflection, but also a good point. Now that I think about it, all the employed men in that side of my family went bald, and maybe our jobs are killing us and my homeless uncles have it figured out, or maybe what they lost isn't on top of their heads. But there I go again, making metaphor of real life. But it's funny because my grandfather's father wasn't around, and leaving is the physical trait I've inherited from that side of my family, and not just an evaporating hairline. I guess when I think about it, I don't. Or I guess when I think about it, I don't feel no type of way because I ain't even know the guy. This is called Out South. This is in the book. It starts with a quote from the Robert Frost poem, Out, Out. The quote is this. And they, since they were not the one dead, turned to their affairs. In Chicago, kids are beaten. They crack open. Their pavement. They don't fight. They die. Bodies bruised blue with wood. Cameras catch us killing. Capture danger to broadcast on Broadway's We Roseland stars. Made players for the press, apes cage from first grade until. Shake us, we make terrible tambourines. Packed into class, kids pass like kidney stones. Each street day is unanswered prayer for peace. News gushes from mom's mouth like schoolboy blood. Ragtown crime don't stop, only waves, hello. Crime waves break no surface on news, goodbye. Every kid that's killed is one less free lunch, a fiscal coup. Welcome to where we from. This is called Hood Woods. From the woods, raccoons, squirrels, rabbits, possums, rats ran together like teammates. The trees clumped menacing as a group of big boys until smoke started to pour toward the park on our block. We heard our mother's best white voices rattle alarm into the telephone. Every kid and old folk perched on porches, watched the black smoke swallow the neighborhood like black folk did 40 years ago. The temperature raised, and we took off our windbreakers, saw orange lick up tree trunks. We thought we felt rain, and all us kids danced, until we noticed our shirts fading, our hair graying from what burning reigned over us. This is called Buying New Shoes. He sees the Nikes, boxed, beautiful, 100+. He hopes. He holds the box under his arm like a briefcase for the unfortunate business of being told no.
It's the poetry of Nate Marshall. Thank you so much. That was great.
No, thank you. This is fun.
You've been listening to Prosody, WESA's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in every Saturday morning at 6:30 for Prosody, 90.5 WESA.